On behalf of the New York State Secession Center Collaborative, I would like to turn the call over now to Dr. Jeff Willett, the director of the New York State Tobacco Control Program. Go ahead, Dr. Jeff Willett.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Jeff Willett, director of the New York State Department of Health's Tobacco Control Program. On behalf of the New York State Cessation Center Collaborative and the New York State Smokers Quitline, I would like to welcome you to today's conference call, Tobacco Dependence and Diabetes. Our featured speaker today is Dr. Heather Dacus, director of the New York State Department of Health's Bureau of Chronic Disease Control. During today's call, Dr. Dacus will discuss the increased disease risks for individuals with diabetes who smoke, the prevalence of smoking among individuals with diabetes, and important characteristics often present in individuals with diabetes who smoke. She'll also provide specific recommendations on how to integrate the treatment of tobacco dependence as a routine component of diabetes care. Before we begin today's call, I have some CME logistics that I need to cover. Ciccatelli Associates Incorporated is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This activity is accredited for a maximum of one AMA PRA Category 1 credit. Physicians should only claim credit commensurate with the extent of their participation in this activity. The ACCME requires that faculty participating in a CME activity disclose to the audience any relationship with a pharmaceutical or medical equipment company which might pose a conflict or of interest. Dr. Dacus has no real or perceived vested interests that relate to this presentation, nor does she have any relationships with pharmaceutical companies, biomedical device manufacturers, and or other corporations whose products or services are related to pertinent therapeutic areas. There are no commercial supporters of this activity. Nursing, respiratory therapy, KSAT contact hours, and certificates of attendance are also available for this activity. To obtain continuing education credits, please complete the verification of attendance and evaluation forms sent by email and available on the New York State Smokers Quit Site website. Fax all completed forms to Ciccatelli Associates within 2 weeks of the program in order to receive credit. Certificates will be mailed 6 to 8 weeks following today's program. Now, it is my pleasure to hand the call over to Dr. Heather Dacus. Dr. Dacus?
Thank you, Jeff. Hi, everybody. This is Dr. Heather Dacus from the New York State Department of Health. I'm very happy to be here today presenting on this very important topic. I'm just going to go ahead and get right started. I'm going to be starting at slide 3, just to again reiterate the objectives of the call. So today we're going to be talking about the increased risk of cardiovascular disease, microvascular complications, and mortality among individuals with diabetes who smoke. We're going to be describing the prevalence of smoking among individuals with diabetes, their specific characteristics sometimes seen in individuals with diabetes who smoke, and then finally going over and encouraging tobacco dependence treatment as a routine component of diabetes care. Just to set the stage, if you forward to the next slide, this is a slide of leading causes of death. Every year these may change just slightly, but pretty much chronic diseases lead the way in this list. 7 out of the 10 that are listed here are chronic diseases, including diabetes. If you forward to the next slide, if we delve a little deeper into the underlying causes of these leading causes of death, what's found in studies is that tobacco use is the most common contributing risk factor to the prevalence of these chronic diseases. Smoking is the leading available cause of, the leading avoidable cause of mortality.
Excuse me, Mr. Willett, this is the conference operator. Sir, her line was disconnected from the call. She should be having technical difficulties. Her line, I guess, disconnected, but she should dial back in just a moment.
Okay. Well, we'll wait for everyone. Hey, can you make that announcement to the full group?
Yes, everyone has understood, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Hello.
Heather?
Heather's rejoining. Go ahead.
Hi. Am I back on again?
Yes, ma'am. The lines are muted, and you may continue with your presentation.
Okay. I'm so sorry, everybody. There seems to be some kind of phone trouble in my building here. A lot of phones just suddenly went out. Getting back to the presentation, moving on to the sixth slide, smoking and diabetes. So I didn't in this presentation, there's not going to be a lot of talk about the primary prevention of diabetes by addressing tobacco cessation. However, I did feel it was important to bring up the topic. And studies have been done in the past. A meta-analysis done in 2007 of multiple observational studies in the past showed that active smoking is associated with an overall 40% increased risk for type 2 diabetes. And as you can see from the slide, the findings of these studies do show a dose-response relationship, such that heavy smokers, defined as smoking 20 or more cigarettes per day, has a greater association with the risk of type 2 diabetes than those who smoke less or former smokers. The risk may also be modifiable. Stop smoking, you decrease the risk. Of course, it's not clear from these studies whether smoking causes diabetes, but it does. Smoking does tend to be present with other unhealthy behaviors, including socioeconomic status, lack of physical activity, dietary habits, etc. So moving on to the next slide, the majority of this talk is going to be focusing on individuals with diabetes who also smoke and their increased risk of cardiovascular disease, microvascular complications, and mortality. In 2004, the American Diabetes Association released a position statement acknowledging the increased cardiovascular burden of diabetes in combination with smoking. Despite the body of evidence accumulating on the topic, the American Diabetes Association acknowledged that this increased risk had not been effectively communicated to people with diabetes or providers, and that little evidence showed tobacco use to be consistently and comprehensively addressed as its importance requires. So as we move on to the next slide, this presents the most common, the most well-defined, and well-studied cardiovascular disease risk factors. And the two that I've highlighted here are obviously the two that we're focusing here on this presentation, type 1 and type 2 diabetes and tobacco use. Moving on to the next slide, as we start to talk a little bit more about the relationship between smoking and diabetes, we all acknowledge that individually both of these things contribute to the development of micro and macrovascular disease, including disease of the eye, the nerves, the kidneys, the heart, and the brain. But what studies have found over the last two decades is that together, the risks for these complications increase. So they move on to the next slide. Studies that have been done comparing people with diabetes who smoke and who don't smoke, individuals with diabetes who also smoke have been found to have a greater degree of insulin resistance, higher total cholesterol and LDL, and lower HDL, the good cholesterol, poor glycemic control, and increased risk, again, of such things as neuropathy, end-stage renal disease, retinopathy, cardiovascular disease, and then death from all causes. Moving on to the next slide, additional studies have also found that accelerated progression of microvascular disease, such as end-stage renal disease, nephropathy, even in the presence of the use of ACE inhibitors and adequate blood pressure control, the findings have shown that nephropathy, there is an increased progression of this. Also, adolescents who smoke and have diabetes are at a 50 to 75% greater risk for morbidity or mortality in later life than those who do not smoke. Going on to the next slide, what's really the physiology that may be explaining the reason why there are these enhanced or worse outcomes? Some of the reasons might include smoking, again, decreases the subcutaneous absorption of insulin, meaning so the insulin dosing requirements increase. Smoking has been associated with central adiposity, hyperlipidemia, and increased blood pressure. And then smoking is also associated with increased risk of severe hypoglycemia in type 1 patients. Moving on to the next phase of the presentation, we'll be going into a little bit of the prevalence of smoking among individuals with diabetes. If you move on to slide number 14, showing the prevalence of both tobacco use and diabetes, you can see from the top of the slide that thankfully the prevalence of tobacco use among adults in New York State age 18 and older has had a decrease of roughly 22%. Unfortunately, the same is not true for the prevalence of diabetes. And in fact, in 1998, the prevalence was 6%, but unfortunately, in 2007, the prevalence was 8.2%. So diabetes is going up, type 2 diabetes specifically. Type 2 diabetes is occurring even more frequently now in children, as I'm sure many of you are aware. As we look at the percentage of adult smokers, adults with diabetes, and smoking among those with diabetes, despite the decreased prevalence, current smoking among persons with diabetes has remained stable since 1998. This is depicted in the next slide, showing a line graph of both people with diabetes who smoke I'm sorry, the top line are those individuals, the prevalence of tobacco use over time. The middle line is those individuals with diabetes who also smoke. And then finally, the prevalence of diabetes is the bottom line. And you can see from that center line that there really hasn't been any major shift in the prevalence of smoking among people with diabetes. Moving on to patient characteristics, what are some of the things that are most commonly seen in studies of individuals who smoke who also have diabetes? Some of the studies that have been done have found the following. If you move on to slide 18, a lack of awareness of increased risk for cardiovascular disease, and this does get back to the American Diabetes Association statement back in 2004. A survey done in New York State in 2003-2004 found only 77% of people with diabetes who also smoke noted smoking as a cause of cardiovascular disease, compared to over 90% of people with diabetes who do not smoke. Another characteristic of individuals in this category is that they're often in pre-contemplation stage of readiness. So in other words, they're not planning to quit in the next 6 months when asked. Moving on to the next slide, patients in this category are also more likely to report feeling sad or depressed, concerned about weight management. Both of these things I'll be getting into a little bit more deeply later on in the presentation. Also less actively involved in diabetes self-care. A survey done in Minnesota of health plan members with diabetes found those who smoked significantly less likely to be checking blood glucose frequently or exercising regularly. I'll get into that a little bit more in a few slides. Finally, additional studies that have been done have found these additional characteristics. It tends to be prevalent in those of younger age, those between the ages of 25 and 44, although that doesn't discount individuals younger and older with diabetes who also smoke. Studies have found more commonly African Americans, and then finally lower education attainment. The next slide goes into some disparities in diabetes care that I think are good to know out in the clinical world. This study done in 2007 looked at the disparities in diabetes care between individuals with diabetes who smoke and those who do not smoke. And all of these diabetes care criteria were noted to be statistically significant between these two groups. So the people with diabetes who also smoke were more likely to have more than two A1C tests in a given year. We're less likely to have more than two foot exams in the given year. We're less likely to have had a dilated eye exam, less likely to have received a flu shot, and our latest A1C value was significantly higher than those who smoke, who do not smoke, who also have diabetes. Moving on to the next slide, the good news is that 80% of people with diabetes who also smoke did note being advised by their healthcare provider to stop smoking, although only 50.5% had made a quit attempt. Still a good thing. I did want to point out that in other studies, this 80% was actually found to be higher in comparison to that noted in other studies. And then finally, we get into the final phase of the presentation where we'll spend the most time. And as we make the connection between the increased risk of microvascular and macrovascular complications of tobacco use and diabetes, we need to get into discussing treatment for these for tobacco use and dependence in this population. On slide 24, key messages that have come out of the 2008 update for the U.S. Public Health Service Clinical Practice Guidelines is prevention of tobacco use, and in relation to population of patients with diabetes, the message is to advise all patients with diabetes not to initiate smoking, and also to repeat that messaging, and that may be particularly beneficial in adolescents. And then the other key message is the treatment of tobacco dependence. Make tobacco dependence treatment a routine part of diabetes care. Moving on to the next slide, we talk a little bit more about the prevention of tobacco use. Again, asking all patients with diabetes about tobacco use to acknowledge whether or not they are currently smoking. It may be challenging in adolescents who are trying to sort of find their way in the world and having a diagnosis of diabetes. Provide age-appropriate educational materials to inform patients with diabetes about the increased risk of complications. Advising patients and families not to begin smoking. And then finally, in an office setting, considering the establishment of clinic settings that support a smoke-free environment so that when patients are coming to the clinic, they're getting a reinforced message from both you as a clinician and from the office that they're in that smoking increases the risk of cardiovascular disease and encouraging the prevention of tobacco use. Moving on to the next slide, getting into treating tobacco dependence. So once an individual with diabetes who smokes is you're made aware of that, treating both hypertension and tobacco dependence are key to reducing risk for macrovascular complications. So that point is pointing out that the two things of all the risk factors related to the the increased risk of cardiovascular disease. Both hypertension and tobacco dependence have been noted by both the American Diabetes Association and the National Center for Quality Assurance as the two key things to focus on, and amongst all the other things that are also important in reducing risk for cardiovascular disease. Shifting from solely focusing on glycemic control to also managing cardiovascular risk. And then finally, making tobacco dependence treatment one of the highest priorities in diabetes care. Moving on to the next slide, what I've put in here is the National Center for Quality Assurance standards as they relate to treatment of diabetes. If you see the website at the bottom of the slide, this has to do with the Diabetes Physician Recognition Program. Physicians and then their facilities have the opportunity to become noticed as physician recognition programs. Evaluating a sample of your patients against these requirements can provide you with valuable information about your patients and your practice. And if you see at the bottom of this list here is smoking status and cessation advice and treatment, such that 80% of patients with diabetes in the sample of your practice have been asked about smoking status. And for those who smoke, they've been provided with cessation advice and treatment. Moving on to the next slide, again to reiterate, the American Diabetes Association in 2004 recommends inclusion of prevention and cessation of tobacco use as an important component of clinical diabetes care. And every year since, the American Diabetes Association Standards of Medical Care has recommended to advise all patients to not smoke and include smoking cessation counseling and other forms of treatment as a routine component of diabetes care. So how do we do that? In moving on to the next slide, I'm sure many people on the call are familiar with the five A's. So how does that relate to the individual with diabetes who also smokes? Well, starting right up front is asking all members of the healthcare team to be trained to inquire about the smoking status of all patients with diabetes. Who asks the question is not as important as asking the question consistently. So from every visit, addressing the topic of tobacco cessation, whether or not the individual seems to be ready or has stated that they're ready to make a quit attempt. Moving on to the next slide, the second A for advice. All members of the healthcare team are trained to strongly encourage smokers to quit and provide reasons for why this is beneficial to the person with diabetes. Again, same comment as on the previous slide. The type of healthcare provider giving that message is not as important as giving the message consistently and emphatically at every clinic visit. So ask, advise, and then we move on to assess. So all members of the healthcare team are trained to inquire about a person's willingness to quit smoking at this time, and again, at every clinic visit. And just to pause here, one of the patient characteristics noted in the beginning of the presentation was that more commonly these individuals are in the pre-contemplation stage. But although these people with diabetes who also smoke are more likely to be in pre-contemplation, those given advice to quit in studies have been found to be further along in the stages of change. And that should be seen as a success, moving somebody from one stage to the next, moving them towards the decision to quit smoking. Moving on, if their individual is ready to quit, the fourth A is assisting them, providing them with cessation counseling and support, such as setting a quit date, ideally to take hold of that momentum and set that quit date for sometime within the next 2 weeks, encouraging them to talk to their family, friends, and coworkers about quitting and gather the support for them when they make this decision, anticipating challenges to the upcoming quit attempt and talking about them openly, removing tobacco products from the environment, so asking the individual to make an assessment of their work, their home, their car, and make those places as smoke-free as possible. Moving on, in the same category of assisting, if you go to the next slide, discussing common behaviors associated with smoking and ways in which behaviors can be associated with new, healthier activities. Acknowledging weight management concerns, acknowledging possible presence of depression, and again, I'll be getting into these two things a little more fully in a few slides. Offering pharmacologic treatment if desired. The U.S. Public Health Service Clinical Practice Guidelines does recommend the offering of pharmacological treatment if there are no other contraindications to doing so. And then finally, referring to additional services in the community to help support the behavior change. So you'll recognize that none of these recommendations are necessarily particular to individuals with diabetes who also smoke, but they're certainly worth reiterating because they can be helpful in all populations. And then finally, the fifth A is arranging close follow-up soon after a quit date to reinforce and support positive changes in behavior. Establishing an office recall system to identify those so you don't lose them to follow up. Remind them of the quit line support, and I've included here the 1-866-NY-QUITS phone number. For patients who are abstinent, congratulate them on their success and talk to them about continuing that abstinence. If tobacco use has occurred, discuss with them what the circumstances were and elicit some recommitment to total abstinence. And then anticipate potential noncompliance. Work with your office staff and your office systems to have follow-up on missed appointments for these clients and follow-up via phone if necessary with those who plan to quit. So what if you are asking, assessing, advising, and it's determined that the individual is not ready to quit? If you move on to the next slide, one of the biggest messages is not to give up. Help move your patients towards change. And some of the ways in which you can do that are making it relevant. Give them reasons for quitting, encouraging the patient to indicate why quitting is personally relevant to them, addressing with them the risks of continued smoking, asking the patient to identify potential negative consequences of tobacco use. The rewards of a smoke-free life, the clinician should ask the patient to identify potential benefits of stopping tobacco use, might suggest and highlight those that seem most relevant to the patient. Identifying roadblocks of successful quitting, asking the patient to identify barriers or impediments and provide treatment that could possibly help address those barriers. And then finally, repetition. Maybe not on the same visit, repeating it over and over again, but certainly at every clinic visit, re-addressing the topic of tobacco cessation. So the next two slides get us into the two sort of special considerations for these populations. Weight concerns we'll talk about on the next slide. And the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey has found an average of roughly 4.4 kilograms and 5 kilograms of weight gain for women. But major weight gain after smoking cessation is not common. Even though some individuals may think that smoking is keeping their weight down and that therefore may be helping them with their diabetes management, it's really important to discourage smoking as a tool to maintain diabetic control. And again, from some of the things we talked about earlier, smoking has a negative effect on lipid profiles. It increases insulin resistance. And so overall, a modest weight gain in the short term is going to be offset by the long-term health benefits of cessation. So talk to your patients about this. Maybe consider a referral to a dietitian. Help patients develop a healthy diet and a meal plan and emphasize physical activity. These are things that you're already doing with your diabetic patients, so it can help address this concern if it is brought to the forefront as a concern. Just to add in here, too, the United States Public Health Service clinical practice guidelines have done meta-analyses of studies to find that bupropion sustained release and some versions of the nicotine replacement therapy, specifically 4 milligram gum and 4 milligram lozenge, have been found to delay, but not necessarily to prevent weight gain. So just some things to keep in mind there. Moving on to the presence of depression, it's certainly worthy to point out the fact that compared to the general population, the prevalence of depression is higher in people with diabetes. Mm-hmm. Studies have found 14% as compared to 3-4% in the general population. Depression can certainly interfere with successful cessation efforts, as it can also definitely interfere with adequate diabetes self-management. So addressing depression from the whole spectrum of diabetes care can have benefits in multiple areas. And addressing and treating depressive symptoms, if they're present, is important. And as far as pharmacological treatments that may be beneficial in these cases, the United States Public Health Service Clinical Practice Guidelines has recognized things like bupropion sustained release and nortriptyline to perhaps have some beneficial impact on tobacco cessation in people with a past history of depression. But if you're dealing with somebody with a major situation with depression, perhaps the conversation of tobacco cessation waits a little bit while the depression is being addressed. It will make the quit attempt and other aspects of self-management more fruitful. Moving on to pharmacological interventions, just a couple of general statements. To date, studies have not focused specifically on individuals with diabetes who smoke. I will be talking about one study recently published in the Annals of Internal Medicine that looked at tobacco cessation in individuals with chronic medical illnesses. It did include some people with diabetes, but overall studies have not looked specifically at that subpopulation. Evidence does not promote one particular medication over another, and all smokers trying to quit should be offered medication if desired and appropriate. So moving on to the next slide, these medications look familiar to you all, I'm sure. We have our variety of options, including nicotine replacement options, the patch. It can provide a relatively stable blood nicotine level. And then the other versions of nicotine replacement, lozenge, gum, and inhaler, can be quite helpful for increasing nicotine levels rapidly to help with cravings. Bupropion sustained release may be, again, particularly useful in individuals with depressive symptoms or with concerns of weight gain. And then finally, varenicline. And one thing we may want to keep in mind is that it may not be the best option for individuals with depressive symptoms, given the FDA warning issued in 2008. The U.S. Public Health Service Clinical Practice Guideline does strongly encourage combination of different treatments. Meta-analyses have summarized a body of evidence showing how pharmacotherapy and behavioral counseling and combining individual pharmacotherapies impact long-term quit rates. Moving on to the next slide, this is a recent addition to the slide set. Again, the study was published last month in the Annals of Internal Medicine, a 2009 randomized control trial whose objective was to evaluate the six-month tobacco abstinence rate for outpatient smokers who also have medical illnesses. This study enrolled 127 people, 20 of which had diabetes, and what they compared was a standard 10-week nicotine replacement therapy protocol with a flexible duration triple combination protocol. So in the group who received the standard therapy over 10 weeks, according to the package insert, were recommended to use the nicotine replacement therapy as per protocol, and the treatment group was encouraged to use those medications over a longer duration. They were given specific criteria by which to decrease, which was not typical standard therapy. So they wanted to see if, given the opportunity to use the medications longer and in combination, would there be a benefit to smoking cessation. One point I'll make is that all participants of the study did receive a limited behavioral intervention, just to keep that throughout the study. And after 6 months, the abstinence rates did show 35% in the combination group versus 19% for the patch group only. Although the study was not powered to be a safety study, discontinuation of treatment due to adverse events was similar between the two groups. In the treatment in the combination group, the study did point out there were significant higher reports of anxiety, insomnia, fatigue, and diarrhea, but none of those things were noted by the study to be a reason to quit the study. So finally, moving on to different interventions that have been done to promote tobacco cessation in this population. If you move to the next slide, a randomized controlled trial that was done in Spain with 280 people with diabetes who smoke. The intervention group, 40-minute visit with a nurse, given the option of nicotine replacement therapy and follow-up support. This was based on the How to Help Your Patient Stop Smoking manual from physicians. And after 6 months, 17% of the intervention group had quit smoking, compared to 2.3% in the usual care group. And that was confirmed with urine cotinine, not just based on self-report. And also the study found that there was a significant decrease in the mean number of cigarettes smoked per day in the intervention group compared to usual care. So for even those who didn't report or have their cotinine levels to show that they were tobacco-free, there was a significant decrease in how many cigarettes those individuals were smoking as the study went on. Moving on to the next slide, another study that was done looking at the addition of motivational interviewing into diabetes self-management. This was a randomized controlled trial in Minnesota of 114 people with diabetes who smoke. Both groups received standard diabetes education, and the intervention group received additional counseling and motivational interviewing. Motivational interviewing includes, it's a client-centered counseling approach to help clients recognize and resolve the ambivalence about changing a particular behavior, using such strategies as expressing empathy, developing discrepancy, avoiding argumentation, and supporting self-efficacy. After 3 months, the trend toward greater cessation with the intervention, but unfortunately that was not maintained after 6 months. So overall, the study didn't find that the addition of motivational interviewing led more people to tobacco cessation. However, it was noted in the study that the addition of that interviewing did not negatively impact other components of diabetes self-management. So, you know, making the point that perhaps in another venue, motivational interviewing could be helpful in the effort to lead people towards tobacco cessation. Moving on to one more study, just to make a comment, another study looking at motivational interviewing in group or telephone counseling sessions. This was a study done in Sweden. The intervention group was invited to participate in 8 group sessions or telephone interview and follow-up. The usual care group was sent a letter with advice to quit, and out of the 350 individuals who were enrolled in the study, after 1 year, 20% cessation rate in the intervention group versus 7% in the usual care group. Unfortunately, those cessation rates were self-reported and not confirmed, so it's not easy to say whether there was some bias towards self-reporting smoking cessation. So stepping back now from the actual interventions and the things that we can do as clinicians, looking at environmental changes. If you move on to the next slide, I have a quote here from the American Diabetes Association position statement, that effective systems for implementing these guidelines should be incorporated into the routine practice of diabetes care. So what can be done globally from the office system perspective to ensure tobacco dependence treatment as part of a systematic approach to diabetes care? If you move on to the next slide, these is a collection of recommendations from a variety of commentaries and studies that have been done. Some examples of environmental changes include a healthcare facility policy that requires all diabetes healthcare providers to be trained on smoking cessation. Smoking status is recorded as a vital sign on all clinic patient records. Systems are instituted to routinely provide follow-up contact to patients with diabetes who smoke, especially those noting a readiness to change. And materials can provide education and information about resources for quitting smoking. Another study that was recently published in the Annals of Internal Medicine, I've described on the next slide, an intervention called Can Quit out in Kansas. The objective of this study was to enroll smokers, regardless of their willingness to quit, into a disease registry to compare cessation rates among smokers with varying levels of disease management. So this was a population-based outreach strategy across 50 rural primary care practices in Kansas. It enrolled 750 people, regardless of their willingness to quit. It randomized them into pharmacotherapy offer only, and then 2 levels of counseling intensity. So moderate intensity, 2 counseling sessions each 6 months, or high intensity, which included 6 counseling sessions over 6 months. And after 2 years, 75% of participants accepted at least 1 offer of medication, and across all...
Excuse me, Mr. Willett, this is the conference operator again. Sir, I'd like to make the announcement that she's disconnected her phone line once again, and she should be joining back in momentarily.
Okay, thanks.
Hello?
Heather, your line is now open. You may continue.
Okay, sorry, everybody. Man, this trouble is crazy. Let's move on to slide 47, where we talk about what is success, and we're really drilling down to the end of the presentation now. What is success in this topic? If we have individuals with diabetes who also smoke, how do we feel like we're doing our job? How do we feel like we're being successful? And some points to consider. Multiple quit attempts are likely before smoking cessation is maintained. Success may mean someone moves from being in pre-contemplation to contemplation. And then finally, don't just quit because your patients are not ready to quit. And to borrow the New York State Tobacco Control Program's Don't Be Silent social marketing campaign, these final 2 lines, don't be silent about smoking, and your patients are listening, are certainly things for us to keep in mind. Finally, on a final slide, special considerations. This is a population that's going to require consistent messaging. We all know that diabetes self-management is not an easy thing to do, so we should be vigilant and consistent and perhaps even be creative and closely follow these individuals. Again, don't give up. Move them towards change. Anticipate the potential noncompliance and address it. Acknowledge weight management concerns. And then, of course, be cognizant of the possible presence of depression or other mood disorders. That's the end of my presentation. I want to first apologize for the phone problems, and secondly, thank you all for your attention. I'm now going to introduce Pat Bax from the New York State Smokers Quit Line. Hello?
Thank you, Dr. Dacus, and thank you for that excellent presentation. My name is Pat Bax, and I'm the marketing coordinator for the New York State Smokers Quit Line. And I just wanted to take a moment to fill you in on exactly how the Quit Line can be very helpful with your patients that have not only diabetes but other chronic diseases. Individuals with chronic diseases, as we just heard, are especially vulnerable to the health effects of tobacco. And clients who call the Quit Line are screened for chronic diseases during the nicotine replacement therapy eligibility portion of our telephonic interview. Our coaches reinforce follow-up with their physicians, as well as providing game-framed messages and motivational support of the client's quit attempt. The quit line can also provide support materials, and we provide a variety of such materials, either by calling the quit line directly at 1-866-NY-QUITS, that's 1-866-697-8487, or by visiting our website at www.nysmokefree.com. We invite you and encourage you to reach out to the quit line to help you in your efforts to help your patients be successful in quitting tobacco use. At this time, I'd like to return the call to Michael, our telephone operator, to assist in our Q&A portion of our call.
Okay, and at this time, if anyone has a question, please press 0 and then 1 on your telephone keypad. Okay, and our first question comes from Steve Taylor. Go ahead, Steve.
Hi, Dr. Dekas. I was wondering, there's a commercial on TV law firm for patients who are people who have taken Chantix and experienced side effects. And one of the side effects they mentioned in the ad is newly onset of diabetes. So I was just wondering what the connection was there.
Steve, that's an excellent question, and I'm not familiar with that commercial, and I'm not familiar with what that statement would be. I'd have to look into that a little bit deeper.
Okay, thank you.
I appreciate that.
Thank you, Steve. Our next question comes from Kathy Sforto. Go ahead, Kathy.
You've answered it. Thank you.
I'm sorry. That was a mistake. We don't have a question.
Okay, no problem. The next question comes from Danielle Elizaria.
My question is about, if we're getting people just to up, down, if they come back and say, well, I'm down to half a pack rather than one pack, is holistically, is that helpful?
Yes. From the standpoint of reducing their risk, if you remember back to the first slide, even though it was talking about the association of smoking and the onset of diabetes, there is that dose-response relationship. But, you know, overall, in the mindset of getting people to move towards that final quit attempt, if you're getting them down to half a pack, that's progress. And, you know, again, it reiterates the importance of encouraging them, acknowledging what maybe some additional barriers exist to making that final drop to no cigarettes, and continuing to advise them about the increased risk of cardiovascular disease with the continued smoking. Even though, yes, the risk may be a little bit less, it's still there. It's still significant, and it would be much better if smoking was completely discontinued.
Thank you.
Thank you, Danielle. And at this time, if anyone else has a question, please press 0 and then 1 on your telephone keypad. Okay, Lori Porcaro, go ahead, Lori.
Yes, I'm looking on your website at newyorksmokefree.com. What I'm looking for is, I have a limited time, I'm a diabetes educator, to be with patients. There's many things we need to discuss. In our county, we have a very excellent smoking cessation program. What I'm looking is something to hand a patient with that is nicer than just like, hey, here's the number that you call, that really gives them information of places to go. I don't really, and this, I think this is for most of our practitioners, is not a lot of time during the office visit to actually counsel patients. And I'd like to also give them a handout on diabetes and smoking, all those wonderful things the doctor just went over, so people can sit there and look at it and really let this sink in. I don't see anything specifically for diabetes and smoking on the website, and just please correct me if I'm wrong, but that's what I would love to see, those two items.
Yeah. Yes, thank you very much for your question. We are in the process of updating some of our back sheets, and the current one on diabetes should be up on our site and available, or you can call us directly within 1 to 2 days. It's just being updated. And in the meantime, though, there are other materials that are available, and we also have the provider referral program where you can have your patients call us directly for the coaching. As obviously time is a factor when it comes to counseling patients, and that's why the quit line can be so effective in helping you to support your efforts, and we can coach and support the client. So you can either have them call us directly by giving them our number, and we have a variety of materials that can also provide them with our number, as well as we have a fax referral program, which is explained on our website, And you can also call and speak to one of our counselors and our coaches that will tell you more about that, where you can refer, fax refer a client to our services, and we will follow up by contacting the patient. We try up to 5 attempts to reach the patient, and then you receive a progress report on the outcome of our call and our intervention, as well as if we are unable to reach the patient, they will receive a follow-up letter encouraging them to reach out to us when they're ready to quit.
That's wonderful. Thank you. And
you're very welcome.
I'm on the website. The diabetes-related fact sheet is not there yet, but I will be back on in a couple of days. Thank you.
Yes, thank you for your patience.
Can I add, too? This is Heather Dacus. I'll also, you know, in the meantime, if you're looking for something specific, you can also go to the American Diabetes Association website, diabetes.org, and type in smoking. And they have a nice one-and-a-half-page printout for patients, and it goes over why smoking hurts your health and why quitting is so hard. So you may find those things helpful in the meantime.
Thank you, Lori. Our next question comes from Kim Klein. Go ahead, Kim.
Yeah, I had a question on the Person et al. 2006 study, efficacy of motivational interviewing intervention in group or counseling sessions. I was a little unclear on the results there. Was the intervention group that was offered in two modalities, either 8 group sessions or 8 individual telephone sessions? Was that the consideration?
They were given the option of either the group sessions or the telephone interview, and about 21% of the people who were invited chose the group sessions. So the majority were took up the option of the telephone interviewing and that kind of follow-up. So they were given the choice. It was either or, and then just the usual care.
Okay, so the results here just show the comparison between the group intervention and usual care. The telephone data is not shown here.
Right, I didn't show here the breakdown of group versus telephone. It's all grouped together. That was the intervention. Some of the intervention chose the group. Some of the intervention chose the telephone.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Stan Martin. Go ahead, Stan.
Yes, thank you. Dr. Day, because I was wondering, thank you for the presentation, first of all, but I was wondering, are you familiar with any studies or information that's available or resources that address tobacco dependence and diabetes as it relates to youth and young adults, let's say in the age range of 18 to 24-year-olds?
There are studies that I saw that address mostly tobacco cessation and chronic illnesses in general in adolescents. A lot of the studies I saw regarding adolescents and the link between diabetes and smoking had more to do with showing the increased risk of poor outcomes. So I'd have to delve a little bit deeper if there were specific articles that looked at cessation efforts in that younger population. I didn't find it in the search I did for this presentation.
All right, thank you.
Okay, if there are any further questions, please press 0 and then 1 on your telephone keypad. Okay, next question comes from Mark Wilgus. Go ahead, Mark.
No, this is Dr. Borkowski for Charles K. Post. My question is, I'm walking around the mall and I see these people selling these smokeless cigarettes with nicotine inside of them. Do you have, has this kind of stuff ever been studied in Europe or anything like that? It seems like a good idea. Or do you have any idea what I'm talking about?
I unfortunately do, but I'm not myself familiar with studies. I don't know if perhaps Dr. Willett might have a comment on that, or we could look into that.
Okay, no problem.
Yeah, this is Jeff Willett. FDA is just starting to take a look at those products. They are banning the future import of those products and are considering them to be a drug delivery device that needs additional study. If Pat Bax or someone else has some additional information, please provide it.
Yes, there is a website that has listed all the information about, they call them e-cigarettes. It can be found, the information on these products can be found at tobaccodocuments.org.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Mark. Our next question comes from Patty Jacobs. Go ahead, Patty.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you so much for the wonderful presentation from Harlem Hospital, New York. I was just going over the slides. I was wondering, is there a breakdown for women and breakdown in different categories from 25 to 35, 35 to 44, 44 on up? And also, is there a breakdown smoking-related and diabetes as far as African-American and Hispanic population?
Yeah, you asked a great question. As far as the risk is concerned, studies that have looked at the risk, the increased risk of smoking and diabetes, there have been studies that have been done in subpopulations, including women. A lot of the studies I saw is related to other groups of populations. I'm not familiar with any ones that are jumping out at me right now with focusing on just one population over the other. They're more joined. And then unfortunately, when you're talking about the treating tobacco dependence in these populations, overall, there's not a lot on tobacco cessation and in persons with diabetes, let alone breaking that down even further into additional subgroups.
I'll get the patient
so,
after the call.
You're welcome.
Oh, thank you so much for the answer.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Patty. If anyone else has a question, please press 0 and then 1 on your telephone keypad. Okay, first question comes from Debbie Coates. Go ahead, Debbie.
Hi, thank you. I'm wondering if you could explain to me if there's a movement or why there is not a movement to offer residential rehab or detox, as with alcohol and other drugs, for this such a huge problem.
Of smoking in general in those populations?
Why is there not any kind of detox or rehab like we have with other drugs?
Pat, jump in and save her.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of efforts being done in New York State to enhance tobacco dependence treatment in substance abuse and alcohol addiction facilities. So there is a movement being recognized that tobacco use in populations where substance abuse is a major issue, is just as harmful, if not maybe more so, that the tobacco use than the original substance abuse issue. So, yes, New York State has been promoting, both in policy and in practice, the treatment of tobacco dependence in those populations.
No, maybe I didn't express myself adequately. I don't mean in those populations. I mean that tobacco abuse and addiction itself is treated differently than other abused or addictive substances. Why is that? Why isn't there the same kinds of treatments available when we know it's such a highly addictive substance and causes so many health problems and thousands of dollars in the kinds of treatments we have available now? Am I saying that correctly?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know if I necessarily have a good answer for you.
That's qualified to answer. Jeff, jump in.
Anybody have anything to add who's on the line with me?
This is Jeff Willett. For one thing, smoking is still a legal activity for people of a certain age. It's a legal product. There's a very large industry that's promoting and marketing that product out there. So just from society's view at this point, all of society, the healthcare system and so on, doesn't view smoking the way you've described it, doesn't view it as an addiction that would require the intensive interventions that we provide for other addictions. We provide services through the Quit Line, and we have the network of our cessation centers that are out there working with the healthcare community to increase treatment for tobacco dependence. But there's kind of a shift that is occurring to get folks to understand how addictive and how deadly tobacco use is. So I guess that's a partial explanation for why we don't treat tobacco dependence the same way we treat other addictions.
Thank you. I appreciate your explanation. And I had thought of the fact that it is legal, but so is alcohol. And yet we send people for alcohol detox and rehab all the time. But I hope I see a movement to go the other way. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Coates. Next question comes from Dr. Aboba. Go ahead, Doctor.
Yes, good afternoon. Just a comment about why alcoholism and other treatments are not seen in the same light. I think, number one, we have to think in terms of a large lobbying group that is is responsible for promoting, or if that's a good choice, tobacco use as opposed to alcoholism, where drunk driving is responsible for a large number of deaths. So I think it's the way it is seen in society. And I agree totally with your comment about, you know, it being legal. The question, that's one comment. But the question I do have, I do, when I counsel my patients about smoking cessation, I usually encourage them to set a quit date. And there have been people who said that setting a quit date, the studies have not indicated that it increases the quit rate. And I would like to get the doctor's opinion off that, because I utilize it, but I get the patient to encourage the patient to set a quit date.
So you're saying that after setting a quit date, you haven't seen that to be successful in leading people towards quit?
And not I personally, but it, I went to a seminar recently, and it was said that there are studies that show that getting patients to set quit dates does not necessarily improve the quit rate. I have not really done any study. I do mostly the encouraging and the smoking cessation counseling.
Yeah, I mean, I think your point is well taken, that certain aspects of all of these things on their own aren't necessarily going to lead people towards the change. And then even when part of an overall, you know, you're addressing all five A's and addressing ambivalence and working with them on and different techniques and changing office practice, you're still dealing with an addictive behavior that is going to need time to change. So again, getting back to that, what really is success? You know, success is moving people towards the decision to change. And even though the one time to set a quit date may not, you know, be the an end result getting us to where we want to be, it certainly is helping us lead in the direction. So we as clinicians have to be able to continue to be vigilant, consistent, and you know, work with our patients from where they're coming from.
Thank you. And that's an additional, we need to put more emphasis on meeting patients where they are. Because when I counsel patients, I generally find out what their occupation is. And for example, when I counsel someone who works in the manhole, I said the same way that you think of having a contingency plan for when you go into the manhole, you think ahead of time, you plan for that. When you're trying to quit smoking, you're going to be going out with your friends smoking, you know, who are still smoking and drinking. Set a contingency. Of a contingency plan. How are you going to behave when they say they're going outside just to smoke?
Yeah, that's an excellent point.
Thank you for a great presentation.
Thank you.
Cool.
Thank you, Doctor. Next question comes from Anthony Davis. Go ahead, Anthony.
I think we have just time for one more call.
Right. Hello, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
Reference to the NR, you know, which is the act before that placement, about the straw.
I'm sorry, I think you're breaking up.
Are you with the straw?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear your question.
Are you familiar with the straw?
With the
it's
no,
a nicotine replacement therapy.
I'm sorry, no, I'm not. Hello?
End the call.
Yes, let's finish up, okay? Thank you, everybody, for all your questions.
Thank you, Dr. Dacus. This is just a reminder that our next call will be on June 24th on the Principles and Practice of Motivational Interviewing. If any of our participants need information from your local cessation centers, there is a list on the New York State Smokers Quitline website, and also all of the information, including the Facts to Quit form, are on the Quitline website as well. Thank you for your participation, and we look forward to speaking again with you on June 24th.
Thank you, and that does conclude today's conference call.